You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
It seems the situation is only getting worse. Definitely, it's obvious. You see displacement, people not finding places to stay. People got displaced from the South, from Daya, from Becca Valley, and even from areas of our fellow Christians. They as well got displaced.
Lebanon is in a state of crisis as Israel intensifies its war. Video has emerged of Israel blowing up an entire village. Meanwhile, the death toll from an Israeli attack on a municipal building has risen to at least 16, including the town's mayor. We'll go to Beirut for the latest. Then, as aid groups warn Israel is wiping northern Gaza off the map, the Biden administration is threatening to cut military assistance to Israel, but not for at least 30 days.
Given you are already saying humanitarian assistance is very low and putting in front of Israel a bunch of concrete measures on how to improve it, why are you waiting for another 30 days to implement the law?
Because we believe it's appropriate to give them a chance to cure the problem.
We'll speak to former State Department official Josh Paul, who resigned in protest last year. He's just launched a lobbying organization called A New Policy. Then we'll look at Israel's threat to launch retaliatory strikes against Iran as fears grow of a broader regional war. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Israel's two-week-long siege on northern Gaza continues. Rescue workers say dozens of bodies remain buried under collapsed buildings in Jabalia, where Israeli strikes earlier today on a UN-run school sheltering displaced Palestinians killed at least 19 people, including children. Hospitals warn food and fuel is running out. Dr. Hossam Abu Safia, director of Kamal Adwan Hospital, recorded this video late last night.
The nursery is full of cases. They are critical cases in nature. This baby here was only a few hours old when his mother was targeted right after giving birth, so his mother, father, and grandmother were martyred. This baby is now alone and has an injury to his head, which led to a secondary infection, and now he is receiving the needed treatment.
At the UN Security Council Wednesday, U.S. Ambassador Linda Thomas Greenfield suggested the U.S. would start to demand evidence from Israel it is not intentionally starving Palestinians.
Policy of starvation in northern Gaza would be horrific and unacceptable and would have implications under international law and U.S. law. The government of Israel has said that this is not their policy, that food and other essential supplies will not be cut off. And we will be watching to see that Israel's actions on the ground match this statement.
This comes as a new report by Politico reveals a top Biden administration official told aid groups in late August that the U.S. would not restrict arms and funding to Israel, even if Israel blocked food and other aid from entering Gaza. Liz Grand, Biden's special envoy for Middle East humanitarian issues, reportedly told the heads of over a dozen aid groups the U.S. would never, quote, hold anything back that Israel wants, unquote. Inside Gaza, Palestinians say Israel's deliberate man-made famine has been evident for months. This is Karam Safi, a displaced Palestinian in Khan Yunus, who's been working with aid groups to provide food to up to 16,000 people.
Due to the closure of the aid crossings and the permanent siege of the north and south, we were compelled to distribute these lentils, and with very simple resources and capabilities so that we can serve these people. I expect a very big catastrophe, a very big catastrophe, I mean of a special kind. Why? Because most of the adults and children will die of hunger, and the Israelis are doing this intentionally. They are carrying out the siege to kill the people one way or another, not by strikes, but by famine. The goal is to humiliate the Palestinian people.
Meanwhile, UNRWA, which has been defunded by the U.S. since January, is warning it may soon no longer be able to function.
And I will not hide the fact that we might reach a point that we won't be able anymore to operate. And if we cannot operate anymore in Gaza, it's not just UNRWA as the main provider of services, but you have also the rest of the UN system, which very much rely and depends on the platform that the agency has offered so far. So we are very near to a possible breaking point. When will it be? I don't know, but we're very near of that.
Israeli airstrikes have hit eastern Lebanon's Bekaa Valley shortly after Israeli forces warned residents it will attack the region. Before the latest warning, 25% of Lebanon was already under forced evacuation orders from Israel. Meanwhile, the UN interim force in Lebanon reports its peacekeepers have once again come under, quote, direct and apparently deliberate fire, unquote, in southern Lebanon. We'll go to Beirut to speak to journalist Rania Abu Zaid after headlines. Meanwhile, Syrian media reports at least two people were injured when Israel launched an airstrike on the port city of Latakia. This comes as the Pentagon announced U.S. B-2 bombers launched so-called precision strikes against five Houthi targets in Yemen. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said the attacks are in response to Houthis, quote, destabilizing behavior. Houthi fighters have attacked vessels in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden since November and vowed to continue until Israel ends its assault on Gaza and Lebanon. Kamala Harris has appeared for the first time on Fox News just weeks ahead of the November election. In what was widely described as a combative interview with Bret Baier on Wednesday evening, Harris asserted her administration will break from the Biden presidency.
My presidency will not be a continuation of Joe Biden's presidency. And like every new president that comes in to office, I will bring my life experiences, my professional experiences, and fresh and new ideas. I represent a new generation of leadership.
On foreign policy, Harris called Iran the greatest threat to the U.S. and touted ongoing U.S. weapons shipments to Israel. Harris also defended her hardline stance on immigration.
I do not believe in decriminalizing border crossings, and I've not done that as vice president. I will not do that as president.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has laid out a so-called victory plan in a speech to Ukraine's parliament, proposing to end Russia's war in Ukraine by late 2025. The five-point plan calls for an immediate and unconditional invitation to Ukraine to join NATO. It would also guarantee weapons sent to Ukraine by its allies could be used for attacks on Russian soil and would see Ukrainian troops replace U.S. troops in Europe after the war. Russia's foreign ministry condemned Zelensky's plan as an escalation and warned it could push Russia into direct conflict with NATO. This comes as President Biden heads to Germany today, where he'll discuss U.S. and European support for Ukraine. The Wall Street Journal recently reported the number of Ukrainians and Russians killed or wounded since Russia's invasion in early 2022 has topped 1 million people. An Italian naval vessel carrying 16 asylum seekers who were intercepted in international waters docked in Albania Wednesday, the first in a highly contested new plan by Italy to transfer refugees to Albania while their cases are being processed. Rights groups say the policy likely violates international law. This is Giorgia Linardi with the rescue organization Sea-Watch.
The Italy-Albania plan is a way to circumvent responsibilities on asylum. It's another attempt to militarize borders and to delegate responsibilities over the protection of people on the move to other states to make sure that the eyes of the justice system and of the civil society cannot monitor, denounce, and protect those people. It's clearly not a question of space. There is no need for Italy to go and build extremely costly detention centers in another state.
In Nigeria, at least 153 people were killed Tuesday when a fuel tanker exploded in the northern town of Majia. Another 100 people were injured. The blast occurred as people gathered around an overturned tanker to collect the spilled gasoline. It was one of the deadliest road-related accidents ever recorded in Nigeria. In Mexico, the mayor of Candelaria Losicha in Oaxaca State died after he was attacked outside his home Tuesday. Román Ruiz Bojerquez is the second Mexican mayor to be assassinated this month. Mexico's recently inaugurated president, Claudia Sheinbaum, has vowed to tackle violent, organized crime. Community members mourned Bojerquez at his funeral Wednesday.
Today they killed a leader who only had the aspiration to make his community shine, his town, Candelaria Losicha. On behalf of all of my colleagues, I ask for justice for his death, that it does not go unpunished.
Here in New York, a federal district judge on Wednesday sentenced Mexico's former top security official to more than 38 years in prison following his conviction last year for accepting millions of dollars in bribes from the drug cartels he'd been tasked with prosecuting. Genaro García Luna served as Mexico's Secretary of Public Security under former President Felipe Calderón, the architect of Mexico's U.S.-backed so-called war on drugs, which has led to the killing and disappearance of tens of thousands of people. García Luna also worked closely with U.S. counter-narcotics and intelligence agencies. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals has denied an 11th-hour request by death row prisoner Robert Robertson to hold his planned execution today, despite evidence his 2003 conviction for the murder of his 2-year-old daughter was based on, quote, junk science. Unless Texas Governor Greg Abbott or the U.S. Supreme Court intervene, Robertson is set to be executed at 6 p.m. this evening. The appeals court ruling came even after a bipartisan group of lawmakers requested a stay of execution, writing, quote, "We believe it would be a stain on the conscience of the state of Texas for an execution to proceed while efforts are underway to remedy deficiencies in how the law was applied to this case." Robertson's conviction was solely based on forensic testimony that cited the, quote, shaken baby syndrome hypothesis, which was popularized in the early 2000s but never scientifically validated. The Supreme Court has left in place an Environmental Protection Agency rule curbing carbon dioxide emissions by coal and gas-fired power plants. In a brief ruling handed down Wednesday, justices rejected an emergency request by states and fossil fuel industry groups to block the EPA from enforcing rules the agency says will prevent carbon pollution equivalent to the annual emissions of some 330 million gasoline-powered cars. The case now heads back to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. In California, the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Los Angeles has agreed to an $880 million settlement with 1,353 people who survived sexual abuse by priests. It's the largest settlement of its kind in the U.S., made possible by changes to California law that lifted the statute of limitations on civil cases brought by survivors of child sexual abuse. And in Puerto Rico, Congress members Nidia Velázquez and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez formally endorsed the candidates of the Puerto Rican center-left alliance, known as the Alianza, ahead of November's election. The Alianza, which brings together the Puerto Rican Independence Party and the Citizens Victory Party, has appealed to Puerto Ricans disaffected with the two main parties over corruption scandals, austerity policies, and the disastrous privatization of the electrical grid. New York Congressmember Nidia Velázquez, the first Puerto Rican woman to serve in Congress, spoke Wednesday from Puerto Rico as she endorsed Alianza and its candidate for governor, Juan Dalmau.
If political parties with different positions dare to make an alliance to fight for a change in Puerto Rico, the logical step for me is to support them. Today, in front of the sun, I welcome hope and give my endorsement to Juan Dalmau for governor of Puerto Rico, Ana Irma Rivera Lassen for commissioner in Washington, Manuel Natal for mayor of San Juan, and the rest of the candidates of the alliance.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh in New York with Amy Goodman in Washington, D.C. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Nermeen, and welcome to all our listeners and viewers and readers around the country and around the world.
We begin today's show in Lebanon. The United Nations says Israel's war on Lebanon has displaced 1.2 million people, including 400,000 Lebanese children. Earlier today, the Israeli military attacked the Bekaa region in eastern Lebanon after ordering more people to flee their homes. This comes as the death toll from Israel's attack on a municipal building in the city of Nabatea has risen to at least 16. Lebanese officials denounced the attack, which killed the city's mayor and five other city workers who were holding a meeting to discuss distributing aid in the region. Meanwhile, the UN says its peacekeeping forces in Lebanon came under, quote, direct and apparently deliberate fire from an Israeli tank on Wednesday. The tank fire damaged a UN watchtower and destroyed two cameras. In other developments, video has emerged of Israel blowing up a historic neighborhood in the Lebanese village of Mahabib. On Wednesday, U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller was questioned about the attack by Matt Lee of the Associated Press.
I want to go just to Lebanon for a second, because there was this footage that appeared, I guess, overnight of Israel blowing up an entire village in southern Lebanon. What do you make of that?
So I've seen the footage. I cannot speak to what their intent was or what they were trying to accomplish, what their targets were. I don't know what they were. Obviously, we do not want to see entire villages destroyed. We don't want to see civilian homes destroyed. We don't want to see civilian buildings destroyed. We understand that Hezbollah does operate at times from underneath civilian homes, inside civilian homes. We've seen footage that has emerged over the course of the past 2 weeks of rockets and other military weapons held in civilian homes. So Israel does have a right to go after those legitimate targets, but they need to do so in a way that protects civilian infrastructure, protects civilians.
All right, I'm not sure I understand. I cannot speak to what their intent was or what they were trying to accomplish. Isn't it pretty clear that what their intent was? Whether they had a specific target in mind or not, blowing up an entire village, that seems to be pretty self-revelatory.
I don't know what was in those buildings. I don't know what was potentially underneath those buildings. That's when I say I can't speak to what they were trying to accomplish.
That was U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller being questioned by Matt Lee of the Associated Press. Well, we go now to Beirut, where we're joined by Rania Abu Zaid. She's a Lebanese-Australian journalist and author based in Beirut. Her new piece for The New Yorker is titled War Comes to Beirut. Rania, welcome back to Democracy Now! If you could respond to the latest news, the places and the scale of the Israeli airstrikes in Lebanon.
Well, actually, a month ago today, the war in the south became the war in Lebanon, with Israel's mass detonation of thousands of pagers across the country. And that was followed the next day with a similar triggering of explosives in walkie-talkies. And it heralded an escalation that continues to this day. So Israeli attacks have been ramped up in terms of the scope of the attacks, in terms of the frequency, the geographical location, and also the targeting. You mentioned in your intro the attack yesterday on Nabatea's municipal building. Now, Nabatea is a provincial capital in southern Lebanon. The Israelis had earlier called on its residents to evacuate. Some were unable or unwilling to. And the local council members, some of them including the mayor, stayed behind to provide aid, bread, to distribute bread to those people, and they were killed. Just in this past week, we have seen airstrikes on homes that have been sheltering displaced people. This week there was an attack on a house in northern Lebanon, which is the opposite end of the country from the Israeli border, and it killed more than 20 people. So we are seeing a definite escalation that started a month ago and doesn't show any sign of letting up.
Hey, Rania, if you can talk about Israel saying they are only targeting Hezbollah. talk about the map of who is getting bombed and also talk about what Hezbollah is responsible for, not only a military wing.
Yes, no, Hezbollah is not only a military wing, it is also a political party. It has members of parliament, more than a dozen of them. It has ministers in this government and certainly in governments over many years past. It has a vigorous and active social services arm, which includes first responders. They have also come under attack by the Israelis, and many of them have been killed. So it's a multi-armed organization, which is an integral part of Lebanon's social and political and military fabric. In terms of the victims of these Israeli strikes, I mean, I can tell you that the death tolls. The daily death tolls are in the double digits, and most of those people who are killed are women and children. In that attack in northern Lebanon that I mentioned, there was an 80-year-old woman who was killed along with two babies. So it's not just going after Hezbollah. We've heard this before. We've heard this in Gaza, that they're only going after Hamas. And it's the same thing that we're hearing here. I mean, yesterday, as you mentioned also in your intro, Israeli troops rigged an entire village in southern Lebanon, which is very close to the border, and they blew it up. This is the Gaza playbook.
Are in Beirut for your latest piece for The New Yorker. You've been speaking to people who've been displaced there, tens of thousands. If you could tell us what they were saying and what the situation in Beirut is as more and more people are displaced from areas around Lebanon.
Well, first of all, the Israeli drones don't seem to leave the air. They don't seem to leave the skies over Beirut, and they're not just over the southern suburbs, which is where Hezbollah had offices and a presence. It's everywhere across the city. It is this incessant buzzing. The displaced are being housed in more than 1,000 facilities across the country, including more than 700 schools and educational facilities. There are also many people who are still on the streets. Just yesterday, I was with a group of hundreds of displaced people who are in an area very close to the coast, to the Lebanese coast, in an area called BL, and they're staying. I can't even call them tents because the four sides were completely open to the elements. It was just a piece of canvas overhead, and these people are displaced from all over Lebanon, not just from the south. They were displaced from the southern suburbs of Beirut, an area known as Dahiya, and as well as the Bekaa, which has also come under bombardment, and elsewhere. There were Syrians among them, too. So, yes, the government has opened more than 1,000 shelters, but it's not enough given the sheer volume of people who have been displaced. Many have also been taken in by Lebanese into their homes, and that is why some of these houses, we've seen some of these displaced people who were taken in by Lebanese and other parts of the country come under Israeli attack.
And Rania, if you could talk about the number of people you spoke to who consider themselves anti-Hezbollah, how are they feeling now?
Well, it's definitely the sentiment here is that this is now a war on Lebanon and that there is no safe space. When Christian villages in the north and in the south can also be targeted, there is a sense that you just don't know who Hezbollah, Israel is targeting. They claim that they are chasing Hezbollah operatives. Who knows? There are question marks about that. Is there any proof of that? Like yesterday when they blew up the village in the south, they said that there were Hezbollah tunnels under this. They seem, again, this is part of the Gaza playbook. They can say that there is a command center, Hamas command center under one of the hospitals and blow it up. So there's a sense that, there are certainly Lebanese who disagree with Hezbollah's decision to open what it called a support front to ease the pressure off Gaza. That was how Hezbollah described its support front. There are Lebanese who disagree with that. There are Lebanese who blame Hezbollah for dragging, dragging the country into the war. And there are many others who see Hezbollah as the frontline defense against Israeli not only airstrikes and attacks, but also there have been attempts over the past 2.5 weeks or so for Israeli ground troops to enter southern Lebanon, and they have faced very fierce resistance from Hezbollah fighters in the south.
Well, if you could respond, Rania, to what Netanyahu has said about Israel's intentions in Lebanon. He said that the Lebanese basically need to eliminate Hezbollah unless people of Lebanon, he says, quote, take the country back and free themselves from Hezbollah. Lebanon would be turned into Gaza. I mean, your response, people are saying, suggesting that what he wants, what Israel really wants, is to instigate a civil war in Lebanon. Is that the general sentiment?
That is the general sentiment, and that is a sentiment that was conveyed from some of the country's top politicians down to some of these displaced people who are still on the streets of Beirut. That is a that's how it was interpreted, that he's basically saying, turn on each other, or we will turn you into Gaza. And we see these efforts to try and foment this suspicion among Lebanese. There are, in all of those cases that I mentioned, when displaced people who were taken into homes in other parts, in non-Shiite areas of Lebanon, were targeted by the Israelis. There is this sense that the Israelis are trying to make Lebanese fear each other, to try and make the people of the south almost outcasts, and to make people afraid to take in the displaced into their homes and into their communities. This is compounded by the fact that in recent days, Israeli journalists just casually tweet something saying, hey, you know, what's happening in a garden in a particular neighborhood? And that causes widespread panic when the Lebanese fear that perhaps that garden, they're saying that because that garden or that facility might be targeted. Just before we went on air, there was a report that the Al Jazeera offices in central Beirut have also received a similar warning and that they have now been evacuated. So there is this this panic and this sense that Israel can target whatever it wants, whenever it wants, and that they're with complete impunity.
Your response also to Prime Minister Netanyahu, Rania, saying that he's demanding UNIFIL soldiers get out of combat zones, alleging their presence is providing a human shield for Hezbollah. And overall, talk about the significance of saying that the peacekeepers, I think there are about 10,000 of them in southern Lebanon, should get out of the way. Many saying they want them, that Israel wants them out because they don't want international observers describing what's happening there. But how UNIFIL is seen in Lebanon?
Well, I'll tell you how UNIFIL has responded to those threats. And UNIFIL has said that they're not going anywhere. UNIFIL is the peacekeeping force that is stationed along the UN delineated blue line, which is the border between the two states. It is their role to stay there and to monitor what is happening there. We've seen five attacks now, direct Israeli attacks on UNIFIL bases. They have wounded peacekeepers. They have taken out surveillance cameras on some of these bases. They've also, on one occasion, actually used a bulldozer to try and bring down a wall on one of these UNIFIL bases. So it's all part of this effort to sort of intimidate and to attempt to discredit not just UNIFIL, but the UN. We've seen the same thing with UNRWA, which is the UN agency which is tasked with dealing with Palestinian refugees. Beyond that, I mean, we saw Netanyahu himself at the UN General Assembly stand on the podium there and call the UN anti-Semitic. Israel has declared the UN Secretary General persona non grata in Israel. So it's all part of this coordinated effort to try and discredit the UN if it points out things like international law and the laws of war and international humanitarian law and, in fact, UNIFIL's mission and why it is in southern Lebanon.
Rania, could you explain, this idea, this doctrine, the Dahiye doctrine, and whether, which is named, of course, after the area outside Beirut, which has come under a fire from Israel, and whether you think that's actually in effect now. And I just want to just quote a brief passage from your New Yorker piece where you point out, I mean, just to give a scale, a sense of the scale of Israel's assault, a number of health workers have been been killed, health facilities targeted. You quote Air Wars, a British conflict monitor, who told the Washington Post that Israel's offensive in Lebanon was, quote, the most intense aerial campaign that we know of in the last 20 years, of course, with the exception of Gaza. So if you could explain the Dahiya Doctrine and your sense of whether it's in effect now.
Well, the Dahi Doctrine was created basically after the 2006 war. And to put it very bluntly, the idea is that you cause so much pain to a community that you try and pry public support from the group, from the non-state actor, in this case Hezbollah. So the